This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. This evening, I have the great pleasure of talking to Erin Harrington. How's it going?
I'm well, thank you, Hugh. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I've watched a kind of spectacularly not good, but also fascinating movie, courtesy of your recommendation, which is a lot of fun. It's a comparison that could lead you to think in the wrong direction, I think, but it reminded me a bit of when me and my brother used to, like, when we were teenagers, we used to dig through my dad's record collection, and he wasn't really a fan of it, but for whatever reason, he had a few, like, Max Miller records, if you're familiar with Max Miller. Yeah. So if people aren't familiar with Max Miller, he was an English kind of music hall-y comedian, and his specialty was dirty jokes where you got away with it by leaving out the punchline. And in some ways, the movie that we're talking about, which is Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill from 1965, reminds me a bit of that because it feels like you're supposed to be way more scandalized than what you're by what you're seeing than you actually are. And I think that's probably just that it's from 1965, but it also feels a bit like it's implying that there is all of this stuff that might happen and then it kind of never quite does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny you say the dad record thing, because I also would dig through my dad's records, and I still have some of them, chucked out the generic stuff, and I have a lot of, like, weird prog rock, which would have, you know, inevitably these sort of fleshy, bulbous, strange kind of covers to them, luridly painted, and I feel a little bit like this film is a version of that as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, by way of starting the conversation off, how did you become aware of this movie? Were you, like, a Russ Meyer fan otherwise, or?
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't actually remember the first time I saw it or how I came across it. Like, so in my day job, I'm an academic. I mostly look at film, and my big love is genre film, particularly horror, but also other speculative and increasingly weird and wonderful areas of filmmaking, right through into what you would call paracinema. So basically the margins, I guess you could say, and the margins where things like rules and taste start to break down too. And when I was at high school and university, you know, I'd go and get, I think it was back in the days of Blockbuster, you could go get five whatevers for $10, and you'd come home and you'd watch them all, and you'd go back the next day and do it again. And so I must have encountered this one of those kind of late teen, early 20s binges.
Yeah, it was a fabulous era for cinema, because it's a bit like something like Netflix, where you never know what you're going to get, except that you and your friends are all drawing from the same, like, limited, but limited in a very idiosyncratic way, pool of movies. And so you can have these things that really don't have any cultural impact anywhere else, have, like, a massive cultural footprint just for, like, the teenagers of Dunedin circa 1996. Like, there's this movie that I was convinced was, like, an art house movie that somehow vanished, called The Punk. And it turned out that it did have, like, a film festival impact when it came out, which I think is like 91. But mostly it just had an impact on me and my group of friends, because it came out before the famous Romeo and Juliet movie, and it's kind of a riff on Romeo and Juliet. And we all had access to the same video stores that, for some reason, prominently displayed this one movie. And nobody else has heard of it or really cares or necessarily should.
But it's wonderful that you say that, because one of the things I like about this film, and I like it so much that a few years ago when I was putting together a course on sex in cinema in the United States over about a 100-year period, I was like, I have to teach this film, is because of those sorts of things about taste and about what does it mean for this weird fringy film to have such an obsessive fandom, to the point where I think John Waters, you know, the king of trash, has said, I wrote this down actually, he said, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, and of course you've got to get the exclamation marks in there as well, is beyond a doubt the best movie ever made. It is possibly better than any film that will ever be made in the future. So when you have these like little pockets where you've discovered, you know, I was also a video store, you know, walking up and down the horror aisles kid, and you have this tangible relationship to the image and to the experience of watching things together, and you're not just kind of stuck on the end of this ridiculous streaming machine. It turns the act of watching these sorts of films into this whole other event.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, like, some ways, cinema, which is unpolished, is a kind of fascinating glimpse into the concerns of the people making it.
Yes.
And I certainly, like, there's an establishing shot of, I forget who it is, it's one of the three go-go dancers. So the very brief, like, plot synopsis is three go-go dancers murder a guy and kidnap his girlfriend, and then attempt to rob a family who turn out to be sort of crazy rednecks, kind of in the
adjacent, yeah
in the sort of in the Chainsaw Massacre family, but like less gory and more just everything's vibes and implications. But there's an establishing shot where one of the go-go dancers gets out of her car, and she's shot with this incredible low angle that makes her look just gigantic. And I went, I am seeing somebody's kink. Like, it's
Yes, exactly. So this is part of the reason why, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I love this film. There are a lot of exploitation films and also sexploitation films, which I guess you'd count this in, that I feel as a female viewer really compromised or uncomfortable, where you're seeing elements of some stuff and you're like, this is amazing, and then you're seeing other things and you're like, oh, this is actually really squicky and weird. But there's something about this film where you have Russ Meyer, who was like a self-professed dirty old man who loved women's bodies, who loved breasts, who had a real like weird kind of worshipy thing with women. And you have this kind of simultaneous sense of objectification, but in a way that doesn't feel gross to me. I think it's kind of, it's a very vibes-based thing, I think. And when you think about his whole, you know, role as editor and director and producer, and he'd come out of the army and had learnt how to make films and ran his shoots in a very kind of efficient and militaristic way and so on. And then you have these images of these incredible, massive women just like beating the shit out of each other and like karate chopping people and dancing, all within the context of this film that opens with this amazing image of like an optical track as you get this narrator going, you know, welcome to violence, and telling us about, you know, women, aren't they wonderful? Also terrible, but definitely wonderful. I mean, I'm not quoting it properly. Anybody should just go and check it out. It's amazing. But then, so it is pervy and it is kinky, but in a way that doesn't to me feel yuck, I think, especially when you consider the history of nudity on film and the nudie cutie stuff and cheesecake photos and pinups and all of these things that kind of sit within that too. So you have these giantesses basically, and they run amok and it's amazing. And they're defeated, like Vala, who is played by Tura Sitana, who's this incredible just icon. She can only be destroyed by another woman in a car. Like, no man will take her off the face of the planet. So this intersection of kind of violence and aggression and swagger and music and this wild script means that it's fetishy, but fetishy in a way that I don't think anybody's at the butt of the joke. Actually, no, that's not true. The men are at the butt of the joke for a lot of the film. They're ineffectual. They're not very good at doing stuff. They're forever being like outplayed, outclassed, out-sexualized. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
The three central women being shot as these kind of giantesses, and then mm-hmm. like the contrast with how relatively small and kind of flimsy seeming the teenager that they mm-hmm. Kidnap is, and then like the way that they do, like they fight and beat men in fights. It reminds me of like the way that characters are shown in like superhero movies sometimes,
yeah.
or like a kind of like sleaze wuxia. Like there's this parallel world of giant, terrifying women mm. who like can only be defeated by other giant, terrifying women yeah. or forces of nature like cars. Yeah, like it's
Lady Kaiju. That's
yeah,
what it is.
exactly. Yeah. and like the fights are kind of like that as well. Like they're not. I have a kind of an affection because I grew up watching like reruns of old adventure movies, like you know yeah. Errol Flynn and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. It used to play on TV as like TV movies when I was a kid, and I kind of like the weird ungracefulness of fights in those, like
yeah.
that thing where people will resort to the big two-handed smash in the middle of somebody's back, and that's but a killer it's move.
Like, but it's like wrestling. It's like professional wrestling in the way that that kind of sets up narratives and has particular tropes and movements too.
Yeah, exactly.
To get you there, yeah.
And
it's interesting, you know, like talking about things like, you know, monster movies and wrestling and all this kinky stuff, like, and quite, you know, apart from the fact that this film is just this overflowing well of pleasure, as far as I'm concerned, even if sometimes you need to kind of help viewers get to the point where they understand why it is that this is kind of an interesting film. I've certainly shown it to some classes before and they've just been, what are you doing? this is not cool. But if you kind of walk people there, it's okay. But it's the sense that, so what year are we thinking? We're thinking about 1965, 66. You know, we're thinking 20 years post-war, and we're thinking this shift from, you know, the idea of, you know, the boomers and the greatest generation and so on. And these films are like holding up this wobbly funhouse mirror at notions of taste. So if you're thinking about the sort of highbrow Hollywood stuff that's coming out at the same time, this is like an inverted version of that. That also says, well, why is it that that's tasteful and this isn't tasteful? Why is it that it's all right to show women's bodies in that way but not in this way? And how is it that certain types of activities are seen as, you know, legitimate economically or not? When you're thinking, you know, this is the era where Playboy magazine, you know, becomes mainstream, I guess, you know, a symbol of connoisseurship and not a symbol of, you know, people being pervy dudes. There's this great kind of tangle in the middle of this here about taste and who gets to watch and with what view, because it's very camp. You know, it asks you to come in and see it as a comedy and have a really good time with it. And maybe that offsets some of the stuff that could be a bit creepy as well.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, I mean, one of the things that's sort of a barrier to an audience is that while it is really campy, it's not campy in the way that, like, I don't know, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show is, mm-hmm. is the Rocky Horror Picture Show is kind of shouting at you, this is camp. And this movie is very campy, but it could also be entirely earnest and just not very good. And you have to kind of,
maybe it's both. Why not both?
Well, exactly. Yes. But like some of the time you have to kind of make a choice to listen to particular line deliveries or particular character or watch particular character actions and go, these people are having a lot of fun and they're kind of being over the top with it, as mm-hmm. opposed to like, these people have no idea what they're doing. Yeah. And I think, you know, like the thing that points to it being deliberate is that Russ Meyer was just like a handle that you crank and movies come out. Mm-hmm. Like you can't be a guy like that and not at some level know what you're doing.
Yeah. And I think that incoherence is part of the pleasure too. Like, yes, it is campy, and I mean the script is amazing. It's hard boiled, and in fact it's probably the dictionary definition of hard boiled. It's just full of these crazy one liners. But, you know, it's made quite strangely, and the acting is kind of both really compelling and really wooden. And I like that it makes you watch it and go, these things don't have to make sense together in terms of going, well, this is artful and this is tasteful, but there can be pleasure in all of that friction that's going on as well. So when you're talking about the young woman who is kidnapped, so there's this it's like a time trial out on a salt flat, and Vala ends up karate chopping the boyfriend of this girl to death after, you know, it all goes kind of horribly wrong.
It's such a perfect time capsule as well, because it's that moment in the 60s where, like, Eastern finger quote martial arts are terrifying. And so they have this fight, and it's kind of maybe not going to go her way. And then she karate chops him.
Yeah.
And, like, if you look at it just as fight choreography, the karate chop looks like it. He looks like he's got hit with a wet newspaper. Like, it's not sold particularly as a devastating, but it kills him immediately. Yeah.
But she, so Tara Santana, was a martial artist. So she had trained in that area. I was just rewatching that fight just before, and I was reminded so much of the Batman television series of the late 60s as well. Because, I mean, they're like cousins in a way, where you have this over-the-top ridiculous fighting. You've got these, you know, you don't quite have these, you know, cartoony title cards of kapow, smash, whatever else, although it's kind of implied. But you also have this hot brass basically going bow, bow, bow every time somebody gets clobbered with something. And the childlike glee when all of those things come together as well is just like, you know, why would you want a real, quote-unquote, real action sequence when you can have this? This is everything you need. It's so pleasurable. It's so fun.
Yeah, and like, I think, like, glee is a good word for it, because the whole spectacle of watching these women run amok is kind of like giving yourself permission to be bad, you know, like you're siding with people who are being reprehensible and having a fun time being bad. And it just so happens that the people that they decide they're going to rip off are also bad in strange ways. But, like, it's kind of like the glee of watching someone on a rampage, you know?
Yeah. But specifically watching women on a rampage. So this is kind of related to his earlier film Motor Psycho, where you have these three motorbike guys. They rape a young woman, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I don't want to watch that anymore. That there's just this horrendous history of female victimization, often for the pleasure of an implied heterosexual male viewer. And, you know, you can contest that, we can argue about that, whatever else, but it's there.
It's known enough that rape revenge is basically a subgenre, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And a tricky subgenre too, that can go lots of different ways. Whereas inverting it and having these women as these these monstrous kind of baddie characters over the top, and they're ridiculous, like they're in it for the sex, they're in it for the money, they're in it for the glory, they're in it for just the sheer pleasure of beating the shit out of people.
One of them gets given the job of watching the teenager and drinks to the point where she passes out and narrates to the teenager that she's drinking to the point that she's going to pass out. And she's just kind of like, I really like booze. I'm going to have all of it. Now I go to sleep.
Yeah. And again, if you think about, like, the gender roles at the time, you know, we are hovering right at the period where second wave feminism is kind of kicking off in the United States. We're just a few years ahead of the civil rights movement, and then, I guess, you know, the hippie movement and various other things. And it's, you're looking at it going, this is stuff that women, they're not allowed to do. This is a fantasy in its own right as well, for perhaps, I don't know, I keep saying inversion because that's kind of what it's doing, is it's taking these normative gender roles and ways of being and tipping them up on their head. So when you've got the family, for instance, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a good comparison to this, because it's doing this but in a far more visceral and upsetting way. You have this family where you have the patriarch is sort of physically disabled in a way that's meant to, I think, you know, hashtag problematically encode his lack of male power. He has this son who is very bookish. So there's even a comment at one point about, oh no, he reads books, which is a way of kind of talking about his lack of masculinity and virility. And then the other son, who is kind of the hyper masculine one, who's this big hulk of a guy called he's dubbed the vegetable, he is like this child in a man's body. So you have this ineffectual family unit that doesn't have a mother or a sister or a female role in it. And then you have these toxic adventurous superwomen kind of coming in too. And so all of these gender roles that you'd expect from a normative, happy, you know, quote unquote sort of American nuclear family just aren't there. And if those myths and those narratives have always been myths and narratives, but they're very powerful. And so to upend them in this kind of way and to suggest that this group of men are going to fail in part because they've already been feminized in these other ways, while you have these highly masculinized women who are femininely sexual at the same time. It's this great kind of big stew of gender roles being kind of mushed up and then chucked out.
Yeah, and like the lack of like a moral core to the movie as well.
Yes.
Really,
yeah.
Like the only people who really embody, well, the only person who really embodies sort of conventional morality at all is the teenager, and she's just kind of dragged around place to place. Yeah, she doesn't really do anything.
She just cries and moans and squeals and dances around in her. So she's 16 years old. She's dancing around in a bikini. Her mum had to be on set all the time, and she's infuriating.
Yeah, and she exists largely to provide like scale contrast for all of the women
by being she's like really little.
She's like a full head smaller than all of them, and they all give the impression that they could like pick her up and just kind of hurl her out of frame.
Yeah, and she's kind of necessary because in terms of the arc and the narrative of the film, she kind of has to escape, even though, I don't know, I love films like this where you understand that in terms of the plot, something happens and then there needs to be some kind of out at the end. But all the pleasure is in the middle when people are behaving terribly. And she needs to survive as the victim or whatever else, and she's rescued, so to speak, not very well, not very effectually, by Kirk, who's the son who reads books, which, you know, is a terrible crime. But again, she can only do that by becoming like the other women, by getting in the car and mowing Vala down, because there's all of this great association of the women with cars, like it's car culture, it's racing culture. The women's bodies are fast machines. Everything they're talking about is about going fast and being speedy. And in that opening sequence where we have the go-go dancers in the strip club and we have these guys kind of watching them shouting go-go and you have this narration about violence, we keep getting these switcheroo kind of shots between these close-up, low-angle shots of the women in parts of their bodies and then of the stereo system as well. So right from the beginning, there's this sense of women's bodies as machines that kind of do things.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that each dancer gets their own car. Like, often with a group of women go places and do a thing, construct for a movie, they're all put in the same vehicle together, but there's something interesting about kind of giving each one of them a signature vehicle that's kind of their thing.
It's like Wacky Races.
Yeah, but
each of them is a different car as well, and their cars reflect elements of their personality. And I mean one of the many funny things about this film is that you have this setup and we're like, okay, they're go-go dancers, and then nothing kind of comes of it after, except for the fact that they like to boogie around in the desert. But it's the setup for them to kind of dance and to be objectified by these men who seem almost victimized by the intensity of their sexuality, and then they all start cackling like witches and they jump into their cars and then they hoon off into the desert because this is what's pleasurable and good for them. This is about their power.
The relationship between the three go-go dancers is quite interesting as well, because they don't seem like a gang. Like, Vala seems like she's the leader, but the other two seem like they're sort of, they've maybe ceded authority to her temporarily, and they're not really under her control. They don't like do what she wants.
Yeah, so there's Vala, there's Rosie, who is Vala's lover. So there's like a tension there, even while Vala, I mean, all the women go off and kind of seduce various members of the family as well. And then there's Billy, who's the blonde, and she's the drunk, and she's hedonistic, and she's kind of cruel and mean. And it's like they're just these terrible people who've all fallen in together and who have this shared pleasure in ultraviolence. And whether or not those bonds will kind of stick together is part of the film. Just there's so much conflict between them.
Yeah, I mean, it was the other thing that made me kind of feel like it had a kind of a Wuxia vibe, because it feels like a, you know, like an alliance of bandits or something, you know?
Yes. I think that's a perfect way of putting it, yeah. What I will say, though, is that, you know, I was thinking about exploitation films and this being a sexploitation, you know, there's all sorts of different exploitation films and how they often are sort of on the margins. They're often sensational and exhibitionist. You know, they tend to be really low budget. So this is black and white because it was cheap to film in black and white, not necessarily because it had some high-minded artistic aspirations in that sense. And they, you know, exploit an issue or an interest or a hot topic, like a social or a moral panic. Looking at the film and going, well, what is the moral panic that it's exploiting is kind of interesting too, and a nice way into the film for people who might not have encountered much in the way of this sort of thing, Paris cinema in general, let alone films like this, noting that this film is full of these, you know, buxom, enormous dancing women, but, you know, any indication of sexuality is incredibly soft core. You know, it kind of pulls away after they've, you know, sort of had a deep embrace, that actually it's not really porny and it's not really gross when you compare it to some of the other films that have been made in this way.
Yeah, there's a, when they go to the farm where the sort of Chainsaw Massacre Light family live, mm-hmm. there's a water tower where they spend all their time hanging out and having showers just off screen, which again, it's like this sort of like implication that there might be something titillating happening, but you don't ever really actually see it.
Yeah, and it is a few years before we start to get what gets termed porno chic, with the mainstreaming of hardcore pornographic content sort of some years later, not that many years later, to be honest, if you're thinking about sort of Deep Throat and some of those other films. So this exists on the margins of that genre, I guess, especially when, I mean, you can go really deep on Paris cinema. You know, people are like, oh, I watched an Academy Award-winning film, and like you're watching 1% of the sort of films that are available. And you start going into this history of what get called nudie cuties, which are again kind of soft core films with female nudity in them that aren't like naturalist films, which were films that got around bans on nudity by virtue of saying, well, these are nudist colonies effectually. And yeah, there's this really interesting kind of shift around what you get to see on screen or not, and what gets to count as transgressive content or not, especially when suddenly in a few years' time very explicit content is being streamed, I mean streamed, is being screened at least for a little while in mainstream cinemas.
Yeah, and like occupies a cultural position of like, if not good taste, then sort of elevated bad taste, right? Like there's,
yes.
There is that weird period where movies that are straightforwardly pornography are also being like really surreal and kind of weirdly arty and making all of these strange choices.
Yeah, and I mean, even just the notion of bad taste, like I suspect you're like this as well. Like I've always, even when I was really little, been interested in weird film and weird stuff and going, well, what does it we even mean when we say bad taste? Is it about content? Is it about approach? Is it about the fact that things are filmed in ways that are deemed to be poor in terms of their editing and their framing and their acting? And, you know, so few films actually fall into the good taste bucket, really. The history of cinema is the history of bad taste, but we shuffle it off to the margins instead of sticking it centrally. So as someone who studies horror film for a living, most horror film is bad taste. I've been really enjoying the new podcast, Amityvilleville, which is one of the hosts of Reply All and Hyperfixed, and a journalist who used to work for Vice. And they're watching every Amityville movie in order. There's like 96 of them, because there was some sort of copyright drop the ball type thing where the notion of Amityville something hadn't been copyrighted. And, you know, one or two of those films might be even vaguely okay, and the rest of them are varying degrees of appalling. But it's the taste and the texture of that appallingness and what you would call, I guess, the reception strategy, how you sit down and watch them and enjoy them. That's where the rubber hits the road, which is probably a good term for this film as well. What do we do with these films? What do we do with Teenagers from Outer Space? What do we do with the wonderful, incredibly strange film festival that, you know, Ant Timpson has run in various guises for so many years? That is the interesting thing there. Film culture, cult culture around these films, as opposed to just seeing them as works of art that we receive.
I think that is an excellent point to pick up, but we are around about the halfway break, so we'll need to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information.
You're listening to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast produced by Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu, with the support of New Zealand On Air, so cheers for that, guys. I am talking to Aaron Harrington, and we're talking about the movie Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And you were just talking about, like, the fundamental relationship of cinema with bad taste. And you made a point in passing about, like, I watched an Academy Award nominated movie, and that's a tiny percentage. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like Academy Award is in some ways like a negative marker.
Oh, yeah. A colleague, someone I used to work with, called it the best of the middle brow, which of course is the most backhanded compliment you can give. I loved Bong Joon-ho a few years ago when Parasite was nominated, and people going, it's the Oscars, and he's like, it's a regional film award. What's the big deal? But it does like a particular sort of narrow normative, whatever happens to be the good taste of the moment, even if 2 years later those films have been forgotten.
Yeah, and I think, like, watching what that window is from year to year is probably an interesting thing to do. But like you say, because it's aiming for the middle, those movies are by definition, like, you're never going to get something in there where they're taking enormous swings, right? Mm-hmm. I've talked about, in the course of this podcast, about a couple of different movies by the Wachowskis. And one of the things about the Wachowskis is that they almost never take small swings.
Like, they go hard.
Exactly. And so even if a movie they make is in some ways like spectacular garbage or just like weird and incoherent, they've always gone, well, I'm going to do this massive thing. And, and if you set out to do that, at least your failure will be interesting if you fail, you know?
Yeah, and spectacular swings are amazing just for what they are, whether or not they succeed or fail. And, you know, So when I talk about, I guess, Academy nominated films, I'm using that as a proxy for a particular type of, I don't know, I heard them described as cup of tea films the other day. I can't remember what that was in, so apologies to whoever's term I've stolen that from. The sort of nice British films that screen at 10 o'clock at arthouse cinemas, where people can kind of go in and have a nice time and come out not being terribly nudged off their pedestal too far. But human beings are weird and amazing and creative and stupid and wildly intelligent and make very, very strange stuff. And I think you see, I think you see a lot more of the human condition in Paris cinema and in incredibly strange stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, you know, there are films that are incredible works of art. You know, I'm not trying to say that they don't do something. You know, I'm a member of our film society here, and some of the films that get screened there are, you know, capital A art, and I'm very pleased to have seen them in a cinema. But it's only like a tiny sliver, and the rest, it's like, oh, just drift out into the great sea of humanity.
And sometimes, I mean, and this movie is in some ways an example of that, but also to reach back to this movie, The Punk, that impacted mm-hmm. me and my teenage friend group, the thing about The Punk is it's not very good. But it's got a very young Charlie Creed Miles in it, and the mm-hmm. chemistry between him and his Juliet is very intense and very real. And aside from that, there are a bunch of scenes of just punks fucking around in London. Like, they do mm-hmm. like a fake fight where they beatbox at a bus stop, and they get into like a sword fight with pool cues with yuppies in a pub. And
yuppies. Oh no, punks and yuppies.
Yeah, exactly. And the central relationship is really compelling, especially if you see it as a teenager.
Yeah.
And all of the fucking around is maybe like 10 minutes all told of this otherwise not very good movie. But those bits are great, and that's all that's stuck in my head.
Yeah, yeah. And it says, you know, is being good the point of a film? And for something like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, like, there are parts of it that are actually great, but it's a film that's about sensation and feeling and intensity rather than necessarily being capital G good in the way that it's scripted or acted or filmed. And so if we look beyond normal acting and if we look beyond normal filmmaking and start to think, well, what do these express and how do they make me feel and how do these do different things from, say, a really straightforward narrative film, then that's incredible. Because like you know, the things that I remember are weird things or images or moments, and they're often not about the whatever that film is meant to be saying or kind of grounded in. They're moments that make us feel something, whether or not that feeling is a positive feeling or something negative or something really ambivalent.
Yeah, and with Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, one of the things I was thinking is, I'm sure people have done this, I haven't gone and researched it, but this is a sampler's dream. There are so many, like, striking, completely bizarre, totally iconic line reads where, like, if you took them out of context and dropped them in a hip-hop track or a dance track or something, like, they would just present this moment of total bafflement, and then you'd go into the big beat or whatever.
Stone cold, like, the script is great. But also, you know, if you're thinking about the relationship to other media, it has been referenced again and again and again, so it gets very obviously, for anyone who is a Tarantino or Robert Rodriguez fan, it gets referenced in their film Grindhouse. And so grindhouses, of course, were these cinemas which would basically just have stuff running all day, and you can either spend a little at the start of the day or a lot later on, and it would just be churning through. And so many of these films were made really quickly, really cheaply to provide content to cinemas, which is really the history of media, is different distribution or media form outlets asking for more stuff in the same way that we have the VHS boom in the early 80s and blah, 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 blah.
Arguably there's going to be like a future history of Netflix slop.
Yes.
Exactly.
So my version of Netflix slop is the slasher boom of the late 70s to the early 80s, because you have video stores and they're like, we need stuff, and horror being cheap and cheerful and often with a very quick turnaround, that's how those spaces became flooded. And, you know, often if those of us who think about horror a lot, you think about, oh, this golden age of slashers, it only lasted a few years because the boom to bust was so quick. But then with this film, you see this really weird trickle down, like it's visually and musically referenced in lots of ways. I don't know if it's my favourite, but I think it's kind of funny, is the Spice Girls music video to Say You'll Be There is a riff on this, is the Spice Girls hooning around in the desert. And I think it's funny because they're such a, I guess, a contested group, in that on one hand, you know, girl power, whatever. It's this highly, highly manufactured version of a particular type of pop femininity that over time has built this huge fan base, I think. So I'm in my mid-40s now, and my students who are 25 years younger than me completely unironically love the Spice Girls, and they love Britney Spears. They love this highly manufactured pop from the late 90s and early 2000s in ways that kind of makes my skin crawl, but I also appreciate that they have different meanings that they're bringing to it as well. So you have this ridiculous sexploitation film that then is being picked up aesthetically and is basically a marketing tool by this highly manufactured girl group, each of whom are characters in the same way as the characters in this film are, in that they each kind of get their look and they get their car and so on. But there's, I mean, people can go to, I actually think the Wikipedia page to this film has a massive list at the bottom, I seem to recall, of all the different references, be it restagings or, like you say, sampling.
Tarantino's an interesting point to draw, just because when you're thinking about like the way in which lines in this movie are iconic, they're iconic because they're sort of slightly not right, but they're delivered with total confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And Tarantino is by contrast, like someone who's a big fan of this style of movie, but is also deliberately trying to write iconic lines.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot in the Kill Bill films, where, I mean, that's perfect kind of lady kaiju, I guess. You know, Daryl Hannah sitting there with, it's Daryl Hannah, right, with the cigarette and the eye patch, delivering kind of grizzled lines and that sort of thing. And it's funny, like, I grew up watching his films and really liking them, and I've felt, I don't know if more uncomfortable about them over time is the right phrase, but I've had more reservations. Because one of the, you know, I mentioned at the start of our conversation that when you're a fan of this sort of stuff and you have any degree of, say, feminist politics or any other politics, things can get a bit woozy when you start to go, oh, what does this mean? What does this look like? Who's receiving it? What is the framing? And I worry sometimes with ironic pastiched and representations of this sort of thing, like, what are we being ironic about? I think so. I really admire Tarantino's love of paracinema and the back catalogue and so on, but in recycling those images, particularly highly sexualized images of super fighty women, in ways that are far more knowing than these sorts of films, I get stuck between this is amazing and badass, and like you say, this is kind of kinky. You know, he has a notorious foot thing. And where is, yeah, I don't know. I get tangled up in the middle of it quite a lot.
Yeah, I have a similar relationship with Quentin Tarantino. I suspect I'm probably about the same age as you. And again, like, I watched things like Pulp Fiction in the 90s when they were new.
It was amazing.
And they were absolutely mind-blowing. By the same token, I also recently watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the grand reveal of that is we are going to save Roman Polanski, which, we're going to save Sharon Tate, but Roman Polanski is a named character who exists in the movie as a cool guy.
I don't know if you watched or if anybody who's listening has watched X and Pearl, which are the films directed by Ty West that were filmed kind of near you, actually. I have a
fun, entirely pointless piece of trivia. Until we accidentally got ourselves blacklisted from the last pubs where we could play for asking for $100 that we were owed politely. I was playing bass in a covers band, and we did a birthday party gig in the community hall in the middle of nowhere out in rural Manawatu, where they shot the talent show sequence in Pearl.
So you're very close to this.
They still have the big church doors that they fitted onto the community hall to make it look like a church, just lying up against the back of the stage.
Yeah, it's funny. That's so good. So those films, there's X and then there's Pearl and then there's Maxine. And I was really interested in Maxine because I'm interested in, and because I teach this, you know, I'm interested in the history of sex on screen, and that includes the history of pornography and how it becomes mainstreamed. And I watched that film, which is kind of nostalgic, and again, it's this kind of, it's kind of ironic, and it's and I got to the end of it, and I thought, what are we being nostalgic for? Because I felt very uncomfortable watching the film and what it seemed to be celebrating. And what it seemed to be celebrating wasn't the work of individual women, because this is the tricky thing when you start to talk about sex work, is that you're talking about individuals who are operating within the system, but the system itself is deeply unequal. And being supportive of people working within that system doesn't mean you have to be supportive of that system more broadly, but of course it's very complicated. But seeing the way sex was screened in those three films, and particularly the way in which in X, and as a spoiler, there's this older character who's presented, she's extremely grotesque, and we're meant to basically take horrific pleasure in just how awful she is as this older woman. And then we see different images of her as younger, as a sex worker, as highly kind of sexualized in these other films. And I just came away going, who's punching down and who's punching up here? And that is so different to this film, where I don't feel like the people, like the women involved in it, are being objectified in a really unpleasant way. Like, they're certainly being objectified. They're almost being worshipped, which is kind of interesting. But it doesn't have that same imbalance of power to me that you see in other things. So whenever I watch stuff like that, I'm like, well, it's the same with rape revenge films. Some of them feel very progressive. Some of them feel deeply misogynistic and are really interested in making the viewer watch and luxuriate in images of violence, of sexualized violence. And others are, you know, if you think about a film like Revenge, which is amazing, is the complete opposite. It pulls away, it won't let you see, and then you just watch this woman eventually kind of become this phoenix and go on a rampage. I don't know where I was going with that, but it's tricky, and you can kind of start to map out individual films that look a bit the same but have very different outcomes, I think, in the way that they are representing people and bodies and the way that they're engaging with culture.
Yeah, I mean, the starting point of this was talking about Quentin Tarantino and him attempting to sort of,
that's right,
like, ape this movie, but do it as a sort of cool needle drop or
yeah, embrace it
ironically. When Russ Meyer is making this is earnestly the movie that he wants to make, even if even if it is campy and you know, lots of elements of it sort of land half as comedy and half as serious. Like,
yeah, it's like Tarantino is going, I want to make excuses for my Orientalism by putting forward these amazing kick-ass Asian female characters, but it's still deeply objectifying and Orientalist. And Russ Meyer's just going, let's have a good time.
Yeah. And I mean, there was I can't remember the quote from John Waters, but you mentioned him at the start as a big fan of this movie. And there's a quote from him where he says, like, irony is the worst thing, basically. If you want to do something, just do it. And if it's bad and tasteless, then congratulations, you're bad and tasteless. You should still just do the thing.
Yeah, it's funny talking about John Waters. So to put my teacher hat on, when I'm teaching this film, it comes after we've had conversations about camp already, and it comes a week after we talk about But I'm a Cheerleader, which is a film that owes a lot to John Waters. And that, interestingly, kind of starts in a similar way too, where you have the image of this cheerleader character being thrown into the air, and you're kind of getting these little glimpses up her skirt, but you realize that it's a lesbian gaze. You're engaging with this queer gaze as this very, actually quite lovely story, particularly for its time. You know, when you think about the history of queer narratives, and they're often very tragic. You know, you can have all of this, people can have relationships, but only if you die in the end. And this is a film that doesn't do that at all. It kind of finishes with queer, lesbian and bisexual joy. And then to have that image basically contextualize or sit against the image of the go-go dancers at the beginning of this, it's kind of interesting because you have to go, well, whose eyes are we looking through, and to what extent do we align ourselves with that gaze? But I think you can screen this alongside a lot of other films that tease out some of those really fun and playful and transgressive elements that might help a viewer who's new to this sort of thing offset some of the things that might just feel a bit kind of bad and confronting, which is weird. Like, why is this dumb film made like this? Weird.
Yeah, and look, I think we're coming up on time. So thank you so much for coming and having this conversation. This
My
has
pleasure.
Been a lot of fun. I was going to say, just one must also remember that men who have weird, kind of worshipful, strange, kinky relationships with women is also the reason we have Wonder Woman. So, you know.
And the Attack of the 50-Foot Woman and The Incredible Shrinking Man. And like, this is what I love about Paris cinema. You find one and then you find 50. You can kind of dig around more and more and more. So you find these strange films that are catering to specific tastes.
And it's interesting because, you know, now of days, what someone would do if they were deeply invested in seeing a giant woman with no clothes on is they would find a friendly artist on the internet and they would, if they're ethical, pay them $100 and they would...
No, they wouldn't. They'd go straight to AI and it'd be boring.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah. They could also do that. If they were not evil, but like, there's communities where people would get together and say, I am also interested in 100-foot women. But that didn't really exist in 1965, I don't think. So
you'd have to look a bit harder, I think. Yeah.
That's right. So they're just kind of throwing this stuff into the wind and hoping that they find the other people that it works for.
I know, people are just so weird and wonderful. And the more weird films that we can watch, the more we can appreciate the great diversity of human tastes and interests.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I don't think that this is a movie that necessarily has stuff on its mind aside from giant women are awesome and should beat people
up. Sensation. More. Yeah, feeling and sensation.
But a point that I have made with relation to other kind of fringy movies is that sometimes the things they have on their mind are a lot more complicated than the more acceptable kind of Academy Award take on
thing. I'd agree.
And so you can find yourself having a lot more interesting conversation kind of with the film and after the film.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and particularly with Meyer's interest overall in what is middle class acceptable American taste in this moment. This certainly tips that up a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And why does that deserve to get karate chopped to death in the first like 5 minutes of the movie?
This would pair very well with some beach party movies, I think, if you want similar kind of out on the salt flat stuff, boy-girl stuff.
So I like to wrap off this show by doing two things. The first is to ask if you have other things that you would recommend. We've sort of ranged over cinema a bit, but are there like specific things that you would, if someone enjoys this or found it interesting, like that you would point them to?
Yeah. I actually would... It's a very different film, but I'd encourage people to see But I'm a Cheerleader. It's really beautiful. It's kind of engaging with similar things in a really different way, in a female-centric, femme-lesbian way, but again, is similarly camp and playful and transgressive. And like this film, did really poorly when it came out and has developed a cult following. So these would make a really good double feature.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean... I almost want to say just like find somewhere that has an old fashioned bargain bin and get the thing off the bottom and see what it is. Because, you know, this does have a cult status, but also you find a lot of things that have this kind of cult status just languishing in places, you know?
Yeah.
And finally, do you have things to plug? Are you doing things that you want to draw people's attention to?
I mean, actually, what I want to plug is going to the movies, is to just go see something at the cinema. I had the great pleasure of running one of the Q&As for the Weed Eaters Big Forking Tour a few weeks ago, and that's in cinemas at the moment. Anything that people can do to go to the cinema to support New Zealand cinema means that more gets made, whether or not it's some silly stoner horror comedy or something with slightly more rarefied ambitions. Just, yeah, just go to the cinema. Don't treat it like a special event. Just go, oh, it's Tuesday and I've got nothing to do. Head along.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say as a true kind of addenda to go to the cinema, consider joining your local film society.
Yes, you'll get to absolutely
see like festival stuff that you missed.
And cool old stuff that you, like I saw at the Canterbury Film Society the other day, we watched The Wages of Fear, which I've never seen, which was really cool because I love the film Sorcerer, which was made as an American remake of that a few years ago.
Yep. I interview a representative from our local one, and there's been lots of Kurosawa coming through recently, which Kurosawa's great. Even if you're not following the thing, he makes a frame that looks like a pretty picture with lots of interesting stuff going on.
Yep.
It's gorgeous. And the final thing is, if your library does Canopy, you should get Canopy because it's got all kinds of stuff on it that you will be stunned and amazed by.
Yeah. It's all out there. You don't need to go to Netflix. You don't need to go to the others. Just prop up the – I mean, the thing is we show our values by what we spend our money on. These are really good things to spend your money on.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatū People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.